You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
On her way back to Britain, someone forgot to share the details of the Irish border deal with the DUP. Surely, Mr. Speaker, there are 1.5 billion reasons why the Prime Minister really shouldn't have forgotten to do that.
My guests, Michael Goldfarb and Samira Shackle, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Donald Trump's decision for the US to recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Jim Mattis's visit to Pakistan and what that means for security in the region. Plus, Russia gets banned from the Winter Olympics, and we discuss this year's winner of Time magazine's Person of the Year. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to the programme. My guests today are indeed Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster, journalist Samira Shackle, who specialises in social affairs, politics, race and South Asia. A warm welcome to you both. Good to have you with us as ever. Let's kick off today's programme with the, well, sometimes it seems inevitable topic of Brexit. Looking a little bit more at the consequences it could have for the Irish border specifically, and Samira, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. It's been interesting that this is the latest thing that appears to be being mismanaged by the administration. The DUP there says there's much work to be done on the question. We know they talk tough and deliver in that in negotiations internally. Exactly how big a problem, I guess, if we specifically look at the Irish border question, is that for Theresa May and the other actors here?
It's a monumental problem, and it's kind of shocking that it wasn't more of an issue during the referendum campaign. I remember thinking that it kind of beggars belief that, and I think actually really speaks to how ignorant we broadly are in the rest of the UK about that conflict, and particularly people in my generation. I mean, you barely learn about it in school. You sort of, it's been peace for most of, you know, my entire adult life, therefore it's not something people really think about much, and it's astonishing that this wasn't spoken about earlier. A friend of mine who's a Westminster correspondent was telling me about a conversation she had with a civil servant pre-referendum, saying, well, what's going to happen to the Irish border? And he said, well, we don't have a plan because it's not going to happen. Well, you know, look at what happened.
No one's laughing now.
It's a huge issue. It's you know, we're talking about many years of conflict, deep psychological wounds still remaining, and also just the practical fact that this is not a kind of straightforward border surrounded by a buffer zone or whatever. It's a border that goes through residential streets, in some cases goes through houses, that bus routes routinely like weave either side of the border, people work on either side of it. So it's a huge, huge issue.
Michael, do you go along with that reading? Was it just another thing that there was egregious complacency about prior to the vote, and indeed in the months since?
Well, yeah, I think so. And, you know, just to understand that I spent most of the 1990s in Northern Ireland. That was my beat. And I covered that story from the get-go, and or at least the political process that led to the Good Friday Agreement. And what's interesting to me watching this is two memories come to mind. One is in 1992, so that's 25 years ago, the Deputy Prime Minister of Ireland, who was also their foreign minister, Dick Spring, gave me an interview. It was my first trip to Ireland, and landing that interview was a big deal. And after, the peace process hadn't even started, but he was a new, fresh voice. And he said that his goal, he told me, I had it on tape, was not to unite Ireland, but to make the border meaningless. Mm. So now, 6 years later, you have the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, ratified by a vote of 3/4 of the people in Northern Ireland. And I was at the count for that vote. And when it was announced, the DUP, who are now in coalition with the government, with the Tories, stormed out because they were totally against the Good Friday Agreement. And I remember the delegation rushing past me. I had my microphone there to get all the good sound. Half the other Protestants were saying bye-bye Ian, meaning bye-bye Ian Paisley, and they were happy to see the back of him. They tried to wreck it. The DUP went out of their way to wreck it, and eventually they wrecked the other main Protestant party in Northern Ireland. But once they had their hands on the levers of power, they were all for the Good Friday Agreement, and they made it work. And Dick Spring's vision of a border that was meaningless came into being. And now it is completely in jeopardy. And yet, once again, the DUP has decided to try and wreck an agreement to protect a status quo that's been null and void through their own good work, it has to be said, for nearly 20 years. Mm. It's an absurdity, and it may not even be the biggest absurdity related to Brexit, but it is the most dangerous one. Now, my contacts, I've never really lost contact with Northern Ireland, will say nobody wants to go back to war. That's partially because of the economic improvements in the North as a result of the Good Friday Agreement and the extraordinary amount of trade that goes on via Ireland with the rest of the EU. It's an incredibly agricultural area. They sell a lot of agricultural products. And yet here's the DUP acting as wreckers, joining up with the Brexiteers and the Tory party. And that's the dynamic we haven't yet mentioned, Samira. Mm. You know, the fact is that the hardline Brexit people are happy to work with DUP to wreck any deal that Theresa May might bring. The DUP are wreckers, and so are the hardline Brexiteers in the Tory party.
I guess there's one other interesting thing, which is a factor here that maybe changes the dynamic from the 90s slightly, and that's that the other big stakeholder here, of course, remains the Bloc of 27 currently, Samira, and presumably, you know, the Bloc will not take anything less than an entirely satisfactory, on their terms, answer to this question of this border, because nobody in the Bloc that remains will want to see any kind of restoration of a border there, which will prompt, in all likelihood, conflict of one sort and another. How are they going to reconcile the domestic difficulties that the administration in Britain has with moving forward on this?
Well, I think the thing is that it's worse for Britain if we don't work something out, because the it's legally bound that we're going to be leaving the EU at a certain point, and we'll end up with the no deal, which David Davis and his ilk keep sort of bandying about as if it's a sort of threat to the EU, when in fact what that means is sort of going off a cliff edge economically, politically, socially, all sorts of ways for Britain, which David Davis kind of frighteningly, if not surprisingly, today revealed they haven't done any sort of economic forecasting to see what the effect would be. But this
at least he's being consistent in that lack
shocking,
of any.
But this idea of no deal and the Irish border issue being very crucial to moving forward with negotiations for all the reasons that you set out, if that isn't resolved, leaving with no deal is an absolute disaster for Ireland, for the rest of the UK, for all of us.
Michael, there was some interesting responses from the rest of the United Kingdom when there were suggestions that Northern Ireland could get a better deal because their case is unique. And you had people like Sadiq Khan here in London saying, well, hang on a minute, London's unique. We were, 7-3 or more in some cases voting to remain. So where's our special deal? So May, once again, is in a position where she's damned if she does and damned if she doesn't.
Well, would you want her job? I can't be as crude as I'd like to be about the act you have to commit to getting out of this job. You know, we can't say it in this day and age, you know, but I'm sure she wakes up most mornings and says, do I have to do this? And then, you know, she pulls her socks up and gets on with it because she's a vicarage child. As I said earlier, the DUP and the hardline Brexiters are probably happy to resist her on the border issue. And I'm equally certain that Nicola Sturgeon and Sadiq Khan and, you know, others who are working hard to remain or to make it as an innocuous departure as possible are going to use the issue to say, that's right. That's right. You can't solve this. This is an insoluble puzzle. So let's just stay in the customs union. Oh, and then the 27 come back and say, well, if you're going to be in the customs union, you know, we have to have not just free movement of goods and services, but people as well. And, you know, so we're back to square one, because the whole purpose of Brexit, the coalition of Brexit, was the hardline Brexiters just think that England should be, and I say England, not Britain, England should rule the waves again. And the coalition is with you know, the impoverished who've been left behind by globalization and don't want free movement of labor. Well, you know, you can't square the circle. We've got, what, till March 2019, 21, yeah, exactly.
Mm. It's ticking, time is ticking away
so
quickly.
What is that, 15 months? I'd say that it's time for the bookies here in Britain to start offering odds on it not happening.
Okay, well, that's a sobering thought to start. Let's careen from one intractable problem potentially to another and shift the focus to the United States. President Donald Trump plans to formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, reversing decades of American foreign policy. Samira, it's probably easy enough to see why he's making these moves. He was very committed to moving the embassy, and he possibly can't do that even for some time if he makes this pronouncement. So this is a way of being seen to be delivering, I guess, on a campaign pledge. But how damaging could this be if he does indeed confirm it a little later?
Well, it's definitely not helpful, is it? I think it's a clear case, again, of a foreign policy that's designed to play to his domestic audience and shore up support amongst his base. I think there's, you know, one of the reasons that this has not been done by previous American presidents is that there's no discernible benefit to the US in terms of foreign policy interests. Israel is already a very close ally. Yes, it's a frustration for Israel that the US hasn't recognized Jerusalem as its capital, but you know, there is no benefit really to the US. You could argue peace talks are already dead in the water. There's been basically no progress for years and years. But this really is the final nail in the coffin to the US, even trying to be seen as a neutral mediator, I think, from the Palestinian perspective, certainly, if they're accepting a city which is still, according to UN resolutions, shouldn't be recognised as the capital of Israel because it's occupied land and because of the vast prevalence of settlements which are illegal under international law. So any prospect of the US being a sort of neutral mediator in this is gone, were it not gone already. And so, you know, Trump, I think, came into office sort of proudly promising that he was really good at deals and was going to make a deal to solve the Middle East Arab-Israeli conflict. That's obviously not going to happen, although it probably wasn't going to happen anyway.
Well, Michael, I guess that's the point, isn't it? To pick up on that point, which Samira has made fairly explicitly there, this peace process, well, it isn't really one. And so as damaging as this sounds, and instinctively it seems like an incredibly poor idea, there's not much damage in terms of that process that's left to be done. It's already dead in the water, no?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, as Samira pointed out, look, Donald Trump has two basic groups of backers that are, you know, they're right-wing American Jews who contributed lavishly to his campaign. Guys like Sheldon Adelson, the casino and hotel magnate in Las Vegas and Points East. And, you know, the promise was I will move the embassy to Jerusalem. They've been pressing for this for decades. And the other group are, of course, evangelical Christians who, you know, through their eschatology, believe that until the Jews are ingathered to the Holy Land, there can't be the end times. This is biblical prophecy. And until that happens, you know, we're going to be in a situation where Trump is they supported him, and Trump will be making good on a promise to them. But the interesting thing in all this, and I also agree with Samira, I mean, look, this has been going on forever, right? The same people who've been negotiating peace for 20 years are still kind of at it, and they're, you know, all over the op-ed pages in America Today about how terrible an idea it is. The same people on the Israeli and the Palestinian side, with the notable exceptions of Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat, who are dead, it's the same people having the same argument. And so it doesn't, I think on the ground, it really doesn't make much difference. It's just that, you know, these people, you know, who have access to the New York Times opinion page and Washington Post opinion page can make it seem important. Did you happen to read, Samira, there was an interesting thread I saw on Twitter yesterday, I guess, 2 days ago, that was hinting that when Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, visited Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, he was discussing this about the family's intention. Did you read that?
I didn't see that, no.
And that nobody batted, and it would seem that nobody batted an eyelid. It was more a discussion of, you know, what can we do to ameliorate, because we have to do this. What can you do for the Palestinians? Money. You can always send money to Ramallah. You know, doesn't always get to Ramallah. It ends up in Switzerland sometimes. You know, I mean, this is where we're at with this story.
Yet more sobering insights. Let's continue with the US, a different tack perhaps. But again, maybe there's some long-running questions which may be addressed here. This is the trip of Defence Secretary James Mattis to Pakistan. Smira, and I'll come to you. The relationship between the US and Pakistan as it is interesting. And obviously the expectations there, or the requests that the US often makes to Pakistan to assist in these broader foreign policy adventures are interesting. We understand Mattis was trying to find common ground with army officials, with Prime Minister Abbasi and others. What does that common ground look like exactly?
Well, it's kind of, although the rhetoric from Trump in recent months about Pakistan has been kind of rhetorical shift from previous eras. He's very explicitly talked about Pakistan as sheltering terrorists. He's talked about punitive, sort of non-specified punitive actions against Pakistan if they don't do more. But this really is a kind of continuation of a long-running thing. You know, it's not... This isn't the first administration to sort of see Pakistan as a sort of double-faced ally and to raise these kinds of concerns, because these kinds of practices that he's talking about, namely sort of sponsoring or facilitating the Taliban and other groups in Afghanistan, has been going on for a really long time. And so the common ground, of course, is, you know, it's a really kind of symbiotic relationship. America kind of needs Pakistan on side for that, all its activities in the region in Afghanistan. Pakistan needs American military aid. It's useful for it not to be a complete pariah state internationally. And the thing is, I think that even that sort of harsh rhetoric, which Mattis quite notably softened in his trip there, I don't think that alone will be enough to make the elements of the Pakistani deep state, which are supporting these groups in Afghanistan and so on, it's not going to be enough to make them stop doing that, because they obviously see a huge gain to them. They haven't stopped doing it in the last decade, two decades, so they're not going to imminently stop. So I think it's a kind of... there hasn't... Even though the sort of... tone of relations might be slightly different, I don't think it's materially different yet. So we'll see.
Michael, on that point, it's interesting, Mattis seemed to adopt, as Samira suggested there, a sort of mild, a sort of slightly more sort of diplomatic tone or approach vis Pakistan. But one imagines that if he returns to the United States and reports back to the president, one can't imagine Trump being more mild-mannered, more diplomatic in how he receives almost whatever Jim Mattis has to say to him on this point.
No, on this point, there's been some interesting comment, you know, that James Mattis is the Secretary of Defense, but his main job, because the Secretary of State has been so undercut and is himself, has a different approach to how his job should be. I mean, Mattis is kind of a Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and his main job is to be like the guy who cleans up after the elephant. He goes around the world and he talks to the leaders of countries in crisis areas to say, I know what he said. I know who he is. You know, deal with me. I mean, and to calm them down. Because, I mean, the one thing that the Trump presidency has done is that it's got everybody, you know, concerned about really what does he, is he serious? Mm-hmm. Does he mean what he says? He doesn't seem to understand his brief. We can't get there. You know, I don't know what's happening in Pakistan in terms of the State Department, but presumably there is short, you know, the staff that has resigned hasn't been replaced, which is the case throughout the State Department. All those human avenues of communication back to Washington and Pakistan, you know, it's an absolute necessity.
Just to add to that about Mattis sort of cleaning up, Trump has himself been incredibly inconsistent. So this kind of harsh talking on relations with Pakistan more recently came after when he'd become, when he'd taken office as president, had this extraordinary phone call with Nawaz Sharif, who was then Prime Minister of Pakistan, where he just sort of kept telling him what a great guy he was and how every Pakistani he'd ever met was really great. It was all over the papers in Pakistan. People loved it. But it was absolutely bizarre. And then this kind of turnaround. So you get the idea he probably couldn't pinpoint Pakistan on a map and doesn't really know more than what the person he spoke to previously told him.
No, I think you're almost certainly probably right, Samira. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about Russia being banned from the Winter Olympics and we'll discuss Time's Person of the Year for 2017.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards, alongside me Michael Goldfarb and Samira Shackle. The International Olympic Committee has banned Russia from participating in the next Winter Games in South Korea. Michael, always interesting to see the IOC often rather late to the party in terms of addressing malfeasance or suggestions of. So I guess in broad terms, and there are certain caveats and so on here, do you welcome this sort of gesture? It's not just grandstanding. There's a bit of substance here, no?
Yeah, no, I do. I tend to be a little cynical about the whole issue of doping, but and particularly in American sports, where many baseball records in the 80s and 90s were sent by guys who were juiced up, but everybody was juiced up, so it was almost a level playing field. The thing about the Olympics is that there's a core group of nations that dope. It's a minority, and then everybody else is trying to win clean. And if the IOC doesn't step in, and mind you, they could have stepped in before Sochi, Winter Olympics, but that would have set off, you know, kind of the sporting World War III. It would have been really difficult. So, I mean, I think it seems fine. And you know, this is trying to be Solomonic. The Russian athletes who are clean can compete, but not be under the Russian flag. My guess is that in Russia, that news came out yesterday, and today Vladimir Putin announced that he will run again in March, which is not news, but he hogged in a Trump-like move. It's like, bad news is coming from over here. I'll do something to get all the headlines over here the way I want them. So that's what I think is at play here.
And Samira, if we read Michael's, you know, fairly depressing, but probably rather accurate. Sort of description of the system where you have people who are playing by the rules and those that definitively are not. Does this sort of gesture change anything? Because this will be a couple of games where Russia has been, been not competing and neutral athletes not competing under the flag and so on. I mean, that surely makes a difference, doesn't it? Certainly in terms of state-sanctioned cheating programs.
I would have thought in terms of state-sanctioned programs, the kind of systemic problem that appears to have been there in this case. I mean, I'm sure, as Michael says, it's probably not going to stop instances of doping. I think that's seems to be very prevalent in lots of different ways and lots of different ways that are very difficult to detect. But I think the kind of wide-ranging nature of the Russian program, I think it was something like 1,000 athletes between 2011 and 2015, whatever the period covered by that report was. I mean, that's a huge number. And even though the Kremlin's denying any involvement, it's difficult to imagine that happened without some sort of orchestration. It's just such large numbers. So I think it people would probably think twice before having that sort of programme, although I'm sure it's not going to stop certain trainers or smaller groups who think they can trick the system and probably can and are tricking the system.
And Michael, just looking at sort of sporting regulation more broadly, we've had conversations about FIFA and the world of soccer. If we look at the whole Olympic movement, has its sheen, has that lustre been irreparably removed, do you think? Or do actions like this and a recommitment of the original founding ideals of the modern games, at least, can it get that shine back?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think it's had a shine for a very, very, very long time. And this goes back to before the pair of you were born, when I was your age. But look, the Olympic Committee, we don't demand of it anymore, the Olympics, any more than we demand of the World Cup. The World Cup is going to be held in Russia in the spring and summer. It was how Russia obtained the rights to that World Cup. I won't say anything that might get Monocle sued. But there's, you know, one assumes that there were financial inducements to make that happen, that there was sexual favors traded as well. Look, the world of big-time sport, big-time entertainment, we, the public, adore it. Maybe not so much the Winter Olympics, especially when they're coming from Seoul. I mean, who's going to be up in London to watch, you know, people doing a downhill run unless, you know, Kim Jong, what's his name, decides to send his army over the border. I don't think it makes a huge difference, frankly, to our enjoyment of the contests. People just want to be entertained. Bread and circuses. That's the time that we live in.
I was going to say bread and circuses.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. I didn't mean to step on your line.
No, I was going to. It's just funny. Plus ça change and all that over a couple of thousand years.
Okay.
Let's wrap up today's programme by talking about Time Magazine's Person of the Year, the 2017 iteration, of course. In fact, it's not a person, but a group. They've called them the Silence Breakers, those who've come out to give voice to open secrets, apparently, regarding sexual harassment and misconduct in the US. Samira, I guess this was interesting. Donald Trump was saying recently, oh, well, apparently I'm a shoo-in to get this award two times running. And you wonder whether almost an immediate reaction was to go this direction, given allegations surrounding his past. This is, a good thing. We seem to be in an age of revelation. That's positive. But are we in an age, are we at the beginning of an age of real change, or is that too much to hope for so quickly?
It's difficult to say, really. I thought the Time piece about the Silence Breakers, as they call them, was really good. It didn't just focus on the kind of movie stars and very prominent people with a platform. It made a very conscious effort to talk about women in all sorts of industries, all sorts of walks of life coming forward and kind of fighting for change. It was inspiring. It gave a feeling of a kind of broad-based movement across, happening at a grassroots level, across society, across different sectors, across all sorts of different lines. And I thought that was really good. And you do get the sense, at least with the fact that women are able to speak up so much more, it feels like the start of a change. It's, of course, hard to say if it will be. And, of course, that the kinds of conditions which have allowed sexual harassment and assault and so on to be so broad-ranging are much wider than simply the kind of each individual instance of sexual harassment. It's much wider. It's partly the fact that there are fewer women in senior positions and leadership roles, all of that stuff. And actually, on that point, it's quite ironic in a way that I was reading that the Time Person of the Year has not since 1936 have they had a woman who's by herself. They've had women as part of a group, as with this, but they've never once had a woman since 1936, when it was Wallace Simpson. I think that kind of speaks.
Make of that what you will. But Michael, and there is irony heaped on irony. Obviously, there is Donald Trump as a sort of runner-up of this. Is there quite a pointed barb directed towards the incumbent of the Oval Office by that and by this, or is that?
But you know, it'd be interesting. I'm going to be watching my favorite media commentators over the next week to see if that was intentional. Because you know, last week Trump did actually tweet, "I don't have time." You know, they wanted me, but I don't have time, which was a way of saying, you know, I've been informed that I haven't been selected.
Yeah.
Although he was on the shortlist along with Xi Jinping. Mm. And actually, when I saw the shortlist, I thought, well, the Me Too hashtag women, they're in there, and that's good. But I mean, if Xi just made himself the most powerful leader of the Chinese Communist Party since Mao. Hmm. And with the U.S. being led by a clown, it's entirely likely that he set China up for the next couple of decades to really make inroads. Anyway, I just think it is a remarkable, remarkable thing. And while Samira was talking, I was thinking of the film 9 to 5 with Dolly Parton and Jane Fonda tying up their boss, Dabney Coleman, who was so crude to them. And that film came out when? 30 years ago. Mm. And that was the way women had to deal with their situation.
Mm. So final word to you, Samira, on that. Welcomed. And I don't know, is this the way to deal with Trump and his ilk then, to sort of literally make it front and centre, splash it on the front covers in this sort of way?
I think so. I think it's good to keep the momentum up and keep the conversation. And like I said, they really broadened it out. And there was a very direct barb to Trump in the article about the Me Too women. They twice mentioned him, once in terms of the sexual harassment allegations against him and sexual assault, and also as a sort of threat to the media and people's right to speak out. So
there you go. More power to them, I say. That brings us to the end of today's programme. My thanks to Michael Goldfarb and to Samira Shackle for joining us here on Midori House. Thanks too to the people behind the glass, Carlotta Ribello, our producer, our research crew, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman, and our studio manager, Christy Evans. Music next. Entrepreneurs coming your way at 1900 and more on the main stories of the day on The Daily at 2200. I'm Tom Edwards. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening.